our church history overview, we come to the 17th and the 18th centuries. You do not have a specific chapter on this. You are back to the first chapter where we're just going on the skimming. But I'm going to go deeper and give you some insights behind these unusual centuries. You don't often get much in church history on these, but the 17th century I call the greatest century of the Puritans. Now, who were the Puritans? The Puritans were those who sought to return to the purity of the scriptures. So they were reformed, they were Calvinist, they were reformers, they wanted a purity in devotion. And the Puritans are distinct not only for wanting to understand the scriptures well, but to be pure in their devotion to God. And therefore they were very much wanting to reform all areas of life. The first great date when you are dealing with the 17th century is 1611. The publication of the King James Version of the Bible. The King James Version of the Bible stands out as one of the most important publishing events of all time. In 2011, we celebrate the 400th anniversary of the publishing of the King James Version. The British call it the Authorized Version. The Americans call it the King James Version. But the 1611 translation of the Bible stands out like the Tower of London. It's a monument at the heart of the English-speaking world. The KJV is the best-selling book of all time. The KJV, the King James Version, is the Bible that has endured for over 400 years. It has had the greatest formative influence on the development of the English language worldwide. The King James Version is actually one of the very first British things to be made, because it was made by the whole island shortly after inauguration of the United Kingdom, when the Kingdom of England and the Kingdom of Scotland united in one king, who was James the Sixth of Scotland, and he became James the First of England and James the First of the United Kingdom. So this is the first time when King James became king that you had the United Kingdom of Scotland and England. For the 400th anniversary of the Authorized Version, Great Britain hosted more than 70 different major events, including a continuous reading of the whole Bible, a bibliothon, at Blackburn Cathedral. They had symposiums on the KJV at Cambridge University, at Aberdeen, at St. John's College, all hosting special exhibits. Britain issued a special £2 coin, which I have a copy of at our mission headquarters. The British Royal Mail issued a special commemorative stamp. Even the British Broadcasting Corporation, which is so anti-Christian normally, had an hour-long documentary on it. The Duke of Edinburgh, that is the husband of the Queen, launched the official celebrations in the banqueting hall of Whitehall. Many websites were set up to celebrate the Authorized Version. There is no doubt that the King James Version is the most beloved and most respected Bible in all of history. It has an ageless magnificence, a beauty of phrase, a poetical arrangement, which is absolutely unique. It is not possible to understand the history of the English-speaking people without understanding the great King James Version. The King James Version has certainly been even more influential in the English language than Shakespeare in the development and spread of English worldwide. And so the King James Version is the most preeminent Bible translation of all time, and without any doubt it is the greatest example of English literature ever produced. No book has ever had such a great impact on the development of any language and culture as the King James Version has had. Nor can any other Bible translation claim to have inspired so many revivals and so many missionary movements as the KJV. The KJV attracts superlatives. It is the most important book in the English language. It's the most important book in the English religion. It's the most important book in the English culture. It is the most celebrated book throughout the English-speaking world. The most enduring embodiment of Scripture in the English language, it is the gold standard by which all other Bible translations are evaluated. All other versions shall exist, as it were, in the shadow of the KJV. For it has shaped and formed and molded the language in which all the others must speak. The KJV is the most influential version of the most influential book in what has become the most influential language in the history of the world. When an African prince asked Queen Victoria, what is the secret of Britain's greatness? She presented a copy of the Bible to him and said, this is the foundation of our nation. I wish that the leaders of Great Britain today would heed those words and go back to that Bible. So faith comes from hearing, and hearing by the word of God. 1618, the 30 Years' War, one of the most disastrous wars in history, between the Roman Catholics and the Protestants. Europe was split in the 30 Years' War, and Germany was the battlefield over which France and Austria and Spain and Sweden and so many others fought. And Germany was devastated. The land of Luther, the greatest Protestant country on earth, was devastated by the 30 Years' War. 1620, the Pilgrims signed the Mayflower Compact, which is the first written declaration on which America is based. And so a very important foundational statement which showed that America was to be founded on Christian principles, on Protestant, evangelical, Bible-believing principles. If you go into the rotunda in the huge Congress Hall of the United States government, you'll see a massive picture, not only of the Pilgrims signing the Mayflower Compact, but you also see this picture, which is a huge oil painting, bigger than one of these walls, of Pocahontas being baptized, the first Indian officially converted to Christ. And that is of the most prominent in the rotunda, showing that bringing the gospel of Christ to the New World was one of their greatest crowning achievements. And so, 1631 comes up as the year in which King Gustavus Adolphus of Sweden, the Lion from the North, saved the German Protestants from annihilation. He was the champion of the Protestants during the 30 Years' War, and King Gustavus Adolphus is well worth great study, and you will find a whole PowerPoint presentation on him and articles on him on our reformationsa.org website. But this was the Protestant champion in the 30 Years' War, who helped to save the Protestant cause and to defeat the Catholic armies of the Holy Roman Empire. Gustavus Adolphus, when his country had only 1 million population, he made Sweden a superpower through an extremely efficient army. And his slogan was, Gott mit uns, God with us, which was his prayer. But I want to spend a lot of time on Oliver Cromwell and the English Civil War, because 1642 marks an extremely important period of time in English history and the history of parliamentary democracies around the world, and lex rex, the rule of law. If you can understand Oliver Cromwell and understand the English Civil War, it will help you to understand so much of your own history and the history of our governments and the history of the development of the rule of law and separation of powers around the world. It will be a most useful series of insights that would enable us to understand what to do about political and social problems in our own countries. You will be amazed at how this first experiment on the rule of law has lessons for us today. And so you may wonder why I will focus on Oliver Cromwell so much this morning in this first session, but the reason is because he has lessons to teach us that is most relevant. And also, I believe Oliver Cromwell most epitomizes the greatest century of the Puritans. I could have lifted up Gustavus Adolphus, but I think Oliver Cromwell is even more important in terms of the development of the rule of law and lex rex, or the law is king, and the parliamentary representative governments and separation of powers and so many other things. You will see here, if you can understand this part of English church history. So, Oliver Cromwell was one of the greatest leaders to ever rule England, but he was not a king. He was a dedicated Puritan. He was deeply and fervently devoted to carrying out the word of God. If you go into the Houses of Parliament, the Palace of Westminster in England, outside the House of Lords and the House of Commons, there are only two statues. One is Richard the Lionheart, the great Crusader king, who spent almost all of his 11 years as king on crusades. He spent only 4 months in England while he was king of England. And the other statue in the grounds of the Palace of Westminster, the House of Commons in England, is that of Oliver Cromwell, and you'll see why. Richard the Lionheart, whose flag is the flag of England, and Oliver Cromwell. Because without Oliver Cromwell, there would not be a parliament. If you have a parliament in your country, you can thank Oliver Cromwell. And that's what the English do. That's why they give him the most prominent statue outside the parliament. Let me explain why. He was relentless in battle. He was brilliant in organization. And with a genius for cavalry warfare, horse warfare. With a psalm on his lips. And with a sword in his hand. He led his Ironsides, his soldiers, to battle. To victory after victory. First against the Royalists in England. Then against the Catholics of Ireland. And finally against the rebellious Scots. Oliver Cromwell was the first to advance religious toleration, which helped to stabilize the fragile country after the king was executed. His foreign policy was in support of beleaguered Protestants in Europe and against Muslim pirates in the Mediterranean. And this was successful. And he restored the supremacy of the seas to England, and he ended the great threat of Muslim pirates. He came from a distinguished family. Oliver Cromwell was one of the very few people who could trace his family to the pre-Norman conquest times, to original Saxons of England. So his family went back way before 1066. His family were frequently active in the fight for liberty. Six of his cousins were imprisoned for refusing the forced loan of 1627, where the king tried to force a loan without going through Parliament. When he was first elected as Member of Parliament from Huntingdon in 1628, he was only 9 years old. He's only 29 years old. Nine of his cousins were members of Parliament. So he came from a very influential family. 17 of his cousins and 9 of his other relatives served at one time or another as members of Parliament. Born towards the end of Queen Elizabeth's reign, Cromwell grieved England's decline from those golden years. His mother was called Elizabeth, his wife was Elizabeth, and one of his daughters was named Elizabeth, because they greatly respected Queen Elizabeth, this Protestant queen who had stabilized England after the ravages of her wicked sister, Bloody Mary. But England was a country in crisis. In the early 17th century, England was deeply troubled. King James had left his realm embroiled in a conflict in Europe against Spain that had launched the 30 Years' War. The crown was bankrupt. England was universally disgraced. King James was actually not a very good king at all. James's heir, his son, Charles I, had married a French Catholic princess less than 3 months after he had inherited the throne. Great scandal. How can a Protestant king marry a Catholic queen? All of England had been against the Catholic marriage, but Charles had contempt for the opinions of everyone. He lied. He entered into war without parliamentary approval. He made secret concessions with the Catholics. He undermined and interfered with the churches. He sent out agents to collect forced loans, bypassing Parliament, who had the right, the sole right, to collect taxes in Britain. He sent rich people to prison until they paid the ransom he demanded. He was a tyrant. He was a wicked king. Land confiscations multiplied under King Charles. An increasing number of people sent to prison for refusing to hand money over to the crown. He was like a thief. Arbitrary imprisonments, meaning without the due process of law. He deprived people of property without any law. He jeopardized the rights of everyone in the realm. James summarily dissolved Parliament when interfered with his will, and Charles did the same. He scorned a petition of rights. He said Parliament had no rights, it merely had privileges granted by the Crown. The King didn't seem to consider himself bound by any province or subject to any law. And Parliament in 1629 issued a bill that said whoever introduces innovations in religion or introduces opinions disagreeing from the true and orthodox church, whoever voluntarily pays these duties are to be counted an enemy of the country and a betrayer of its liberties. Because they were trying to change the Church of England from a Protestant church back into a Catholic church. And immediately the bill was passed, the king dissolved Parliament. Imagine that, just coming and dissolving Parliament. And he exacted a furious vengeance on Sir John Eliot, who had proposed the motion and others who had supported it. And he was cruel. Elliot and other members of Parliament were thrown into prison. Elliot remained in prison in the Tower of London, dying in the Tower of London in 1632. And you can see Charles's pettiness in that he even refused his widow the right to take her husband's body to be buried back at their family home. Charles appointed and dismissed judges at will. He appointed Archbishop Laud and banned the publication of Calvinist sermons that had been collected since the time of Elizabeth and Edward VI. And he had the Star Chamber. The Star Chamber was run by Archbishop Laud, Archbishop of Canterbury, a hideous, evil, apostate, tyrant of a man who was the ecclesiastical lapdog for Charles I. And you can see the cruelty of Archbishop Laud when he took the Calvinist minister Alexander Leighton for writing one Puritan book. He had him chained in solitary confinement until his hair fell out and his skin fell off. He tied him to a stake and had him flogged, whipped, until his back was raw. He branded him on a face, branded like people would brand cattle. He had his nose slit, he had his ears cut off, and he condemned him to life imprisonment. All that for writing a book. He waged war against the Reformed faith. From the moment Laud was consecrated Archbishop of Canterbury in 1633, the Arminians, who were those who opposed the Calvinists, assumed full control of the Church of England and declared war on the Reformed faith. Calvinist pastors were dismissed from their parishes. Calvinist writers and speakers were excommunicated from the church. They were placed in the stocks. You know what the stocks are? They would have a person sitting in the middle of the marketplace and would have their feet and their hands effectively chained by locking them into wooden stocks so that they were stuck as prisoners. And all day people would come and spit on them and hit them, kick them and throw things at them. And this was a way of public humiliation of someone they didn't like. They'd do that to authors and preachers. And they had their ears cut off. You don't listen, we cut off your ears. The treatment that the Calvinists received at the hands of the Armenian Star Chamber was remarkable because the Armenians accused the Calvinists of being cruel for believing that God's salvation and mercy could be selective. But how cruel could they be in their application of justice? The Armenians also accused the Calvinists of being in favor of a theocracy where the church rules the state. They, however, were ruling the state, and they were ruling the people through the state. For example, Archbishop Laud had the author John Pin hauled before the Star Chamber for seditious libel. He was barred from practicing the law. He had his university degrees rescinded. He was fined an impossible £5,000, which would be about £50 million today. He had his ears cut off and he was sent to prison for life, all this for publishing one book. So these examples just show you a little bit of the cruelty and the arbitrary tyranny of Charles and those who followed him. All these abuses took place during the 11 years that Charles ruled England without Parliament. It's the only time in the history of England there was no Parliament for 11 years. The King said, I don't need Parliament. The longest years without Parliament in British history. Not surprisingly, the Scottish rebelled against this imposition of Roman Catholicism and superstitions and rituals on their churches. In fact, there's a story of this one woman when she saw the bishop at the high church in Scotland going through Roman Catholic liturgy, she picked up a little stool because people walked to church and sat in church on their own stool that they might carry because there were no pews in the church at that stage. She threw a stool, a little three-legged stool that she sat on, that she'd used for milking the cow, at the archbishop and hit him on the nose, caused his nose to bleed, and said, we'll have no Roman popery in our church. Well, the Catholic attempts on Scotland failed, and the Scottish people rose up and they rebelled. And so Charles was forced to recall Parliament because he needed to raise new taxes to raise a new army to go and put down the Scottish rebellion. And this is where the short parliament came in. And all this is important. You'll see it in a moment. So hold with me here. This is important history. The short parliament was summoned on the 13th of April, 1640. But instead of providing Charles with the money and the men he needed to fight the Scots, they immediately started talking about the crimes of Charles's government, the atrocities of Archbishop Laud, the illegal taxation of people, the excesses of the High Commission, the terrors of the Star Chamber. This Parliament lasted 23 days, hence the Star Chamber, before King dissolved it already on the 5th of May. And they had published the remonstrance of the complaints of Parliament against the King. And this led to a kingdom in crisis. A whole series of crisis situations compelled Charles to call a new Parliament. There were Muslim pirates raiding the Irish and Cornish coasts of England and carrying off Christians into Islamic slavery. An English navy was nowhere to be seen. Where was the protection of the people? English settlers were being slaughtered by the Catholics in Ireland. Where was the English army? A Scottish army had seized northern England. And there was a general belief that there was a Catholic conspiracy at work to destroy the Protestant liberties of England and to install a Catholic monarchy. And so comes the Long Parliament. For 11 years, all newspapers had been banned in England. And only the secret circulation of illegal pamphlets kept the people informed on what was going on. Imagine a king who can ban all newspapers for 11 years. But King Charles was being outmaneuvered, and he was being cornered. The Long Parliament moved swiftly. When he had to call another parliament, these guys knew, we've got a very short time, let's act quickly. And they first impeached the Earl of Strafford, who was the king's dictator of Ireland. He was a secret papist, meaning a Catholic. And he was plotting to bring his Catholic army from Ireland to alter the laws and the religion of England. And so Parliament condemned him to death for treason and had the Earl of Strafford, the King's number one right-hand man, beheaded on Tower Hill. And the people gathered in great numbers because he was exceedingly unpopular. The House of Commons charged that Arminian changes in the canons of the Church of England were illegal and they impeached the Archbishop of Canterbury, Archbishop Laud, for treason. He ended up in the same tower that he had impeached and imprisoned so many others in. So what goes around comes around. The wheel is turned. Censorship was abolished. Pamphlets and religion governments couldn't be produced fast enough. The demand was so great that London became a fountain of Puritan publications dealing with God, government, faith and morals. London was a God-fearing city at that stage. The King's government collapsed as ministers fled the country, seeing their day is over. Systematically, the Parliament dismantled the instruments by which the King had oppressed his nation. Now, the people in Zimbabwe and the Parliament of Zimbabwe could learn from the lessons of what Oliver Cromwell and the English Parliament did to deal with a tyrannical, out-of-control king. Unfortunately, they did not learn these lessons. If we knew our history, we could save ourselves a lot of grief in our present days. This is the prototype where we can see how the mother of parliaments dealt with tyranny in England, and it's an example for all the world. No taxes could be levied without parliamentary consent. The Star Chamber and its tortures were abolished. The Privy Council, appointed by the King, was stripped of its powers. The Court of the High Commission was abolished. The King was left financially dependent on Parliament, and Parliament took control of the militia, the military. Oliver Cromwell played an increasingly pivotal role in Parliament. The Long Parliament, which began at sitting on the 3rd of November 1640, was the fifth Parliament of Charles's reign. Cromwell had been in two previous parliaments which had been dismissed summarily by King Charles. And Oliver Cromwell was the ultimate Puritan politician. He was described as having penetrating eyes of steely blue, profoundly religious, well-read, eloquent, full of fervor, with an iron conviction, which his character turned to steel. He was a graduate of Cambridge University. He was a descendant of the Chancellor or Prime Minister of Henry VIII, Thomas Cromwell, who had been such a key element in the Protestant Reformation in England. He was a dedicated Puritan. In 1620, Oliver had married Elizabeth Rocher, and he was an affectionate husband, and he had a deep love towards his children. When he was 28, he was elected to Parliament as member for Huntingdon. And this Parliament lasted less than 5 months before the King dissolved it. It was 11 years before the short Parliament was summoned. So by the time the Long Parliament was summoned, in 1640, Oliver Cromwell was nearly 42 years old, and up till this point he had no military experience. But that was to change, because the English Civil War was at hand. As war became inevitable, it seemed the king's forces had a great advantage of trained and experienced cavalry. And the royalist officers were experienced at fencing and riding. And leading the king's cavalry was his cousin, Prince Rupert of the Rhine, who had fought in the 30 Years' War and was very experienced in the military. And Prince Rupert brought over 100 professional officers experienced in the Dutch and German wars. The first battle of the English Civil War was Edge Hill, 23rd October 1642, as the king's forces, led by Prince Rupert, descended on the parliamentary infantry so effectively that it was almost a massacre. But after thundering through Essex's men, the cavalry stopped to plunder the baggage and lost the advantage of their victory. This gave Captain Cromwell opportunity to counterattack with his cavalry, and Cromwell halted the royalist efforts to march on London, and he saved Parliament. But Cromwell observed to his cousin John Hampton that they will never be able to beat these gentlemen's sons, schooled in sword fighting and horse riding, with old decaying serving men from the farm. Oliver Cromwell said he is going to find honest men who feared God and not the enemy, men who were full of the Holy Spirit, and he would create a special force. Oliver Cromwell set out to select a new force, the first professional army in the history of the world, and these were to be called the Ironsides. Oliver Cromwell's initiative earned him a promotion to colonel, and Richard Baxter noted that Oliver Cromwell had a special care to get religious men into his troops, because these were the sort of men he esteemed and loved. From this happy choice flowed the avoiding of disorders, mutinies, plunderings, and grievances of the country, which debased men and debased armies are commonly guilty of. Nobody ever could point to one atrocity committed by one of Oliver Cromwell's soldiers. His army was disciplined. They never abused people. They didn't take anything that didn't belong to them. They were the first professional army the world had ever seen. He selected and trained 2,000 brave, disciplined, dedicated psalm-singing Baptists as his core of this new model army. And in May 1643, Oliver Cromwell, although heavily outnumbered, attacked the royalist force at Belton and killed over 100 at the cost of only two men. His men quickly earned a reputation as religious, obedient, fearless, disciplined. In October, he won another victory at Winsby. Prince Rupert led the king's forces to massacre the Calvinists of Bolton. And in Cromwell's Ironsides were victorious at the Battle of Gainsborough on 28th of April. And he stood for religious freedom. He rose in Parliament in December 1644 to propose a self-denying ordinance in which all members of Parliament should resign their military commands, or those in the military should resign their parliamentary commands. He said, we cannot do both. He argued for religious freedom. Presbyterians, independents, all have the same spirit of faith and prayer. They all agree here. They know no names of difference. Pity it should be otherwise anywhere. In other words, an army we united, let us respect all religious opinions here in Parliament. All that believe have the real unity, which is the most glorious, because inward and spiritual unity. As for being united in forms, uniformity, every Christian will, for peace sake, study and do as far as conscience will permit. And from brethren and things of the mind, we look for no compulsion but that of light and reason. So he is the first to argue for religious toleration, to not try and enforce one denominational form on the whole country. But he was horrified to find that Parliament was seeking to impose Presbyterianism on the nation. The Baptists, the Congregationalists, the Anglicans, and other believers who were fighting on the fields of battle for religious freedom against the Catholics were now going to replace this with Presbyterian tyranny. They actually wanted to have Baptists executed if they tried to preach, because they wanted only Presbyterians to be allowed to preach. I mean, there's outrageous things going out on in the Parliament. So just because it's Parliament doesn't mean it's right and good. Cromwell demanded the restructuring of the army. He castigated the army with his profaneness and impiety and absence of religion, drunkenness and gambling and all manner of license and laziness. He said this is what's led to defeat. He argued for a new model army, so he's appointed second in command of the parliamentary forces. And out of the total parliamentary forces of 88,000, he selected and trained 22,000. as a new model army, which became the core of the parliamentary forces. At Marsden Moor on the 2nd of July 1644, Oliver Cromwell led his army to victory over the Royalists in the most decisive battle. But now Cromwell was a lieutenant general, and his disciplined, Bible-reading, psalm-singing troops won the day. They won another major battle victory at Naseby, 14th of June 1645, and this marked the end of the First Civil War. Meanwhile, Parliament established the Church of England as a Presbyterian church, with orders to persecute Baptists, Congregationalists, and Nonconformists, to be imprisoned for life, and on some occasions to even be put to death for preaching the gospel in a way that the Presbyterians don't approve of. No laymen were allowed to preach or expound on the scriptures. You could go to jail for life for preaching the scriptures. Can you believe it? If you weren't a Presbyterian. And so Cromwell championed liberty of conscience. He said, "This is not what we have been fighting for." He passionately argued for religious freedom, liberty of conscience, religious toleration. The army did not want to see Arminian absolutism replaced with a Presbyterian version. The independents said, "We don't want a national church. We want all varieties of the Protestant faith to be free of state interference and free of state limitations." This is unique. This is the first time in history religious freedom is being articulated in such a way. When the Parliament sought to disband the new model army, which was overwhelmingly composed of Baptists and Congregationalists and other independents, the Army Council sent a message to Parliament demanding liberty of conscience for its members. Cromwell wrote, "He that risks his life for the liberty of his country, I wish he would trust God for the liberty of his conscience and you for the liberty he fights for." Since we are fighting for freedom, you cannot take that away. The army will not allow it. And he argued for checks and balances because people are corrupt. You cannot trust any people, whether king or parliament, with unlimited power. He proposed a council of state, free elections, an enlarged franchise, the right to dissent with both king and lords, no bishops, no compulsory orders of service for the church, no compulsory obedience to Presbyterianism. Although one of the king's advisers observed, "Never was a crown so nearly lost, so cheaply recovered," King Charles contemptuously dismissed these and other proposals for settlement. Cromwell then became the power broker between the army and the parliament and the captive Charles in an attempt to restore a constitutional basis for their government. However, dealing with a slippery and inflexible monarch, King Charles, exhausted Cromwell's patience, and a second civil war erupted. In 1647, Charles escaped and sought to restart the war with the Scottish Presbyterians. Defeating the Royalist Welsh and the Scottish rebels in 1648, Cromwell supported the trial for treason for the king, which ended in the execution of Charles on the 30th of January 1649, the first time in history that a king has been lawfully tried and executed for treason. Kings have been assassinated, but no king had been put on trial and executed for treason before this time. And this was to prove the point that lex rex, the king, the law is the king. Lex stands for law, rex stands for king in Latin. They used to say rex lex, the king is law. Cromwell turned it to lex rex, the law is king. Christ is over all and his law is over the king. And so the king was put on trial for treason. The 17th of August 1648, Cromwell achieved a tremendous victory at Preston, quickly breaking up the Royalist army and capturing 10,000 prisoners. As on every other occasion, Cromwell was always careful to give all the glory to God. It pleased God to enable us to give them a defeat. And so the army, 18,000 strong with a king in the midst, entered London. And despite the illusions of the Presbyterians in Parliament, the army knew that the army alone had defeated the king. Parliament hadn't defeated the king, the army had. And the army included officers and men who had previously been excluded from all the religious and political discussions. They were determined not to have Parliament send them back to the pattern of the past that they had so successfully fought against. They wanted independent congregations, and they wanted a qualified franchise for the vote. Cromwell emerged as the leader of the independent churches, favoring freedom of religion for all Protestants. Most of our churches would be known as independent churches, and if you're not part of the big denominations like the Anglicans or the Presbyterians or the Methodists. He favored freedom of religion for all Protestants. They argued for rule by the virtuous, selected by men of standing, responsible citizens. They rejected universal franchise. Britain never had a universal franchise before 1922. In other words, they had a qualified franchise. You had to own property to be able to vote. Cromwell increased it to you had to own property or have an educational qualification, and you had the vote. So he wanted to enlarge the property. And he also wanted to make it that no matter, even if a person's got a small amount of property, doesn't have to be a large estate, a big farm, any property, he should be given the vote. Because they said, this universal franchise proposed by the levellers meant that a man with no more fixed property than what he can carry about with him, who's here today and gone tomorrow, you can't enable such people to have the vote because they will just enact confiscatory laws and they will overtax the productive and they'll steal and they will undermine the stability of the kingdom. So they advocated a qualified franchise based on ownership of property, although Cromwell wanted also, or educational qualifications. But Charles was full of treachery and duplicity. While Parliament was arguing over the form of the future and their faith and freedoms, Charles was negotiating with the Scottish, promising to accept and impose Presbyterianism of England. Here he is, working with the Catholics one moment, the Presbyterians another. He's duplicitous, treacherous. The Scottish, who had started the war in the first place against Charles, now decided to support Charles because he promised to force Presbyterianism on all of England. And so now they were committed to bring him to the throne. So, changing sides. And the Scottish issued a manifesto calling for England to accept the covenant and to suppress all religious opinions aside from Presbyterianism. They also demanded that the new model army be dismissed, which was not going to happen. The Royalist Cavaliers, the cavalry of the Royalists serving the crown, from both inside and outside England, hurried to join the Scots in this new conflict against the parliamentary forces. And the second civil war saw the Presbyterians allied with the Armenians fighting against the independence of the new model army. How these theological opposites expected to settle their differences if they ever did defeat the new model army could never be explained. How were the Presbyterians and the independents going to work together? And with the Catholics? No one did answer that because there was no answer available. But Cromwell led his army to victory at Pembroke Castle, sieging this impregnable stronghold in just 6 weeks. Then he forced March's army across the country to intersect the invading Scottish army. In a ferocious three-day battle, he defeated the Scots. Now the king was outraged at the duplicity and treachery of the king that had led to a new war, even against their previous allies, the Scottish. So they demanded a trial for this man of blood. Cromwell wrote to his cousin Robert Habband, who was guarding the king on the Isle of Wight, to make it harder for him to escape. I profess to thee a desire from my heart. I've prayed for it. I've waited for the day to see the union and right understanding between the godly people, Scottish, English, Jews, Gentiles, Presbyterians, Independents, Baptists and all. He wanted a spiritual unity in religious freedom, but they placed the king on trial. 135 men were nominated to the High Court of Justice and the King's trial began on the 8th of January 1648. The trial was held in the ancient Westminster Palace, which had originally been built by the Norman William Rufus. In it, Sir Thomas More, Guy Fawkes and Earl of Strafford had been tried, a very famous and important venue. And Charles was convicted of treason. The indictment against the King was that he had by wicked design erected and upheld in himself an unlimited and tyrannical power to overthrow the rights and the liberties of his people, the Magna Carta rights, the Charter rights of 1215. That he had traitorously and maliciously levelled war against the present Parliament and the people. That he was a tyrant, a traitor, a murderer, a public and implacable enemy of the Commonwealth of England. This is the first time in history that a head of state, a king, is being on trial for violating the law and his oath of office. Think of the tyrants in our country. Think of what is going on in Zimbabwe. Think of what is going on all over the world. Imagine if you had God-fearing people who would call their leaders to account as the English people called their king to account. Evidence was brought forward of illegal taxes, arbitrary imprisonments, mutilations, tortures, executions of the people, whose only crime had been to disagree with the king on matters of faith and ethics. He had trampled on the common law of England and the chartered rights guaranteed by the Magna Carta. The prosecutor argued there is a contract and a bargain made between king and people. A bond of protection is due from the sovereign. The other is a bond of subjection or loyalty due from the subject. If the bond is ever broken, farewell sovereignty. In other words, if the head of state does not provide protection for his people, then the people owe him no loyalty. The king had made war against his own subjects. The authority of a ruler is only valid as long as he provides protection in return. If he doesn't protect his people, he is no ruler and he has no authority and he should go. Despite Charles' attempts to disrupt and derail the proceedings, the death warrant, that death warrant there, was signed by 59 of the commissioners. Cromwell described the execution of Charles on 30th of January 1649 as a cruel necessity. And it was a demonstration to all the world that the king is answerable to God and to his people and to his parliament to uphold the laws and his oath of office. When his son, King Charles II, promised that he would impose Presbyterianism on the realm, the Scottish Presbyterians mobilized to fight their Protestant brethren in England. And here you can see how Christians will be divided against one another out of gullibility in listening to lying, deceiving, treacherous people whose words cannot be trusted. And they fought their own brothers. The Presbyterians of Scotland fought their Protestant brothers in England because of a lie made by a professional liar who could not be trusted in anything, a whoremongering pagan, Charles II. And so a Catholic uprising in Ireland also threatened the new republic. So the Council of State appointed Oliver Cromwell as Lord General of the new army to deal with the Catholic threat in Ireland. Knowing he also had to deal with the Scottish threats, he determined to subdue the Irish quickly as possible. His first action was to reach Ireland and to forbid any plunder by his men. Two men were hanged for disobeying that order when they looted, took some property that didn't belong to them. At Drogheda, Cromwell's forces crushed the Catholic stronghold in a ferocious battle. He then moved to Wexford, long a thorn in the side of the English because it was a centre of piracy, raids by pirates on English traffic on the sea. The town was given a chance to surrender, and when it refused, they were put to an 8-day siege and put to the sword. Cromwell prayed that this bitterness would save much blood through the goodness of God. In fact, these two decisive victories did quieten Ireland, which had been for over 100 years in turmoil. After subduing the major strongholds of resistance in Ireland, he learned that Charles II had landed in Scotland. So he left Ireton, his son-in-law, to complete the mopping up operations in Ireland while returning to England. And the Scottish campaign was short and sharp. Young Charles II had signed the Scottish League and Covenant, swearing to maintain Presbyterianism in his household, which is a lie. The man was a Catholic. He was not going to do this. This is just to get their armies to fight for him. Charles II was crowned king in Scotland. Lord Fairfax, the supreme commander of the parliamentary forces, flatly refused to lead the army into Scotland because he was a Presbyterian. He put his denominational affiliation above his national loyalty. So he was relieved of command. And Oliver Cromwell now, for the first time, appointed supreme commander of parliamentary forces. And Cromwell conquered Scotland with his usual fearful efficiency. His 16,000 well-equipped, well-experienced, determined troops went into Scotland, and although heavily outnumbered and trapped by superior forces, Cromwell decisively defeated the Scottish army at Dunbar. He seized 10,000 prisoners and occupied Edinburgh and Lee. And he tried to reason with his Scottish Presbyterian neighbours. Our brethren of Scotland, are we to be dealt with as enemies because we don't agree with you on all points of religion? Are you sure that your league with wicked and carnal men is a covenant of God? I pray you read Isaiah 28. which says we should not help the wicked. We should not be in partnership with those who hate God. I beseech you in the mercies of Christ, think it possible that you might be wrong. Are you troubled that Christ has preached by independents and Baptists? Is your preaching so inclusive? He argued for liberty of conscience and religious toleration. And his persuasions were somewhat successful, because many of the covenanters chose to be neutral thereafter. And so, on 1651, a year after the Battle at Dunbar, Cromwell's forces defeated another Scottish army at Worcester. Charles II's massive army of 30,000 was put to flight and scattered. It's remarkable that Presbyterians, Armenians, Episcopalians, Catholics had cooperated together to fight the Protestant Parliament of England. Each of these groups believed in traditions of a single faith in a single land, and they were incompatible. And yet they cooperated with their most determined enemies because they hated the independents, the Calvinists, the Baptists, and the Congregationalists of Parliament more. But Cromwell triumphed over it all, as you can see from this very prominent statue outside the House of Parliament in England. The victory of Worcester was to be Oliver Cromwell's last campaign. He was now 52 years old. In 10 years, he had been successful in every battle. In campaign after campaign, he had triumphed over superior forces. His tactics had proved themselves time and again. He was welcomed back into London in triumph in September 1651. And you know what he said as the people were cheering him? He said, "These people would cheer just as loudly if I was about to be hanged." He realized the fickle crowd and their adulation means nothing. The people will cheer one day, "Hosanna, Hosanna," to Jesus. And next week, "Crucify him, crucify him, release Barabbas. We have no king but Caesar." The crowd can be fickle, unreliable. And so he did not let it go to his head that the people were cheering him. He said, "They would cheer just as loudly if I was going to be hanged." As Captain General of the Army and as member of the Council of State, Oliver's position in England was unassailable. But he wasn't the head of state, remember, not yet. The English royalists had been bled white, decisively defeated again and again. Charles I had been executed. Charles II had fled to France. The Second Civil War had ended. England was firmly under the control of Parliament. Ireland was subdued. Scotland had been conquered. The three kingdoms of England, Scotland and Ireland were now united under parliamentary government in London. But there were parliamentary dilemmas to deal with. The situation that confronted Oliver Cromwell on his return to London was shocking. In his absence, England had declared war on Holland, a Protestant neighbor. This was the first war in English history, fought just for economic reasons, because they were competitors to English merchants. Cromwell was horrified that the English Republic would have waged war against the Protestant Dutch. He was shocked at the Licensing Acts and the Treason Acts, which overrode liberties. The war with Holland was resented by the New Model Army. The soldiers wanted to know, when are we going to see the reforms that we've fought for 10 years for? When Parliament refused to renew the Commission for the Propagation of the Gospel in Wales, which was the army's favorite instrument for evangelizing that politically unstable country, it created a storm. Oliver Cromwell was outraged. "This, we apprehended, would have been throwing away the liberties of our nation into the hands of those who never fought for it. We fought for the freedoms of the country, and now the people who never fought for it are wanting to take away our freedoms. This will not happen." And he was horrified by the intolerance of Parliament. The parliamentary interference with the religious liberty of the independents was increasing. So Oliver Cromwell gathered some soldiers, and accompanied by Major General Thomas Harrison, he entered Parliament and listened to their proceedings. And after a while he stood up and he calmly began speaking of his concern that Parliament had become a self-perpetuating oligarchy, unfit to govern England. In 11 years they hadn't once gone to the people they purported to represent to be re-elected. They were the Long Parliament. 11 years! They said we're fighting for freedom, but they haven't even gone to the people for re-election. He said, "You are drunkards and whoremasters. You are unfit to run a brothel. You are no parliament. I said again, you are no parliament. I'll put an end to your sittings." He turned to General Harrison and said, "Clear the room, call him in." army marched in and they chased out the members of parliament. And these members left, some under protest. And this ended the long parliament that had dethroned the king, abolished the House of Lords, created a new government and won a revolution, and now it itself was abolished. Because they had become corrupt, even fighting fellow Protestants in Holland. And Oliver Cromwell now called for a new parliament of 140 members. Some were chosen by the churches, some by generals, 5 from Scotland, 6 from Ireland. But London Puritans predominated. In short order, this parliament reviewed the judicial system, voted to abolish the Court of the Chancery. Tenants were provided protection from arbitrary expulsion from their homes. For the first time in English history, marriages were possible by civil ceremony, those who didn't want to use the official Church of England. Their proposals not to execute pickpockets and horse thieves for first offenders horrified the lawyers, because England at that stage had 300 categories of crimes you could be executed for, including being a pickpocket. Executed, first offence. He said, no, that's not right. That's not biblical. That's too harsh. The punishment must fit the crime. And many of the reforms were constructive, but they alienated the population by seeking to abolish tithes, compulsory tithes to the church. Concerned that Parliament was seeking to undermine the church and secure ownership of property, the army grew impatient and persuaded the members to voluntarily dissolve. So this Parliament dissolved. Now, a committee produced a new constitution called the Instrument of Government. 16th of December 1653, Oliver Cromwell was proclaimed Lord Protector of London, of the Commonwealth of England, Scotland and Ireland. An elective position. Not for life, and not hereditary. He was to be the chief executive, assisted by a council of 15 members, 8 civilians, 7 army officers. Parliament was to retain the power alone to levy taxes and to grant supply to the government, and the protector was not allowed to dissolve Parliament while it was in session. You all know of John Bunyan, who wrote Pilgrim's Progress. You know that John Bunyan was one of the soldiers in Oliver Cromwell's army. How many of you would have read the book, Pilgrim's Progress? Ah, a few. Well, now you know how it came about and why the imagery is in it. Oliver Cromwell believed in an established evangelical church, that the Church of England should include Congregationals, Baptists, whatever types in each congregation. He wanted it tolerant of dissent and with separate congregations where the congregations govern, not an archbishop in Canterbury. The Baptists, the Congregationalists and the Independents all supported Oliver Cromwell. He wanted the new government to have nothing to say on religious rites or ceremonies or sacraments. How to administer the Lord's Supper or baptism is up to each congregation, not up to government. He wanted Presbyterian, Independent, Baptist, Church of England congregations, any form of Protestant worship should be permitted. And the arts flourished. Writers found the protectorate under Oliver Cromwell more lenient than any of his predecessors. Literature flourished because there was no more censorship. There was complete freedom of speech and of writing. And you saw poetry appearing, and Christmas again became festive. Musical entertainments and theatre had been prohibited under the Puritan Parliament, the Presbyterian Parliament before Cromwell, but now that Cromwell was the leader, he changed those laws. So some people blame Cromwell for abolishing Christmas and for banning theatres and music. He didn't do that. The Presbyterian Parliament before him did that. He reversed those rules. Many people say the Puritans were against culture. They were not. The first full-length 5-act English opera, The Siege of Rhodes, premiered under the Protector. Women were allowed to wear makeup in public, which had been banned by the Presbyterian Parliament. Play readings which satirized or ridiculed the government were allowed. There was freedom of speech. During the Commonwealth, the violin became popular. Solo singing began to be enjoyed. And in foreign policy, Oliver Cromwell made peace with Holland, and the British Navy crossed the seas to restore Virginia and the Barbados Islands to England, and he summoned the Spanish ambassador and told him Englishmen in Spanish territories must have liberty to worship as they please, free of the Inquisition, and English traders are no longer to be molested, or England will declare war on Spain. The negative response of the ambassador prompted Cromwell to send an English fleet to San Domingo and to Jamaica, and has succeeded in conquering Jamaica, which had previously been a Spanish territory. And that's why the people in Jamaica speak English today. Cromwell dreamed that Calvinists from New England would settle in Jamaica, but unfortunately it became like Barbados, another place for the English to ship the criminals and rebels, like Australia. Britain took all their criminals and shipped them off, what they called transportation, and sent them to Australia, to Barbados, to other places. Basically, you get them off an island, and then the population of England became so law-abiding because all the criminals were shipped overseas. And he defeated the Muslim pirates. Admiral Blake led the English Navy into the pirate stronghold of Tunis in North Africa, destroyed the ships of the Sultan, and forced the Sultan to release all English prisoners and slaves. And Oliver Cromwell sent his congratulations on this great act and ordered Admiral Blake to proceed to Cadiz and intercept Spanish ships who were carrying treasures from the New World. The Waldensians had been persecuted relentlessly for hundreds of years. And now, as the Duke of Savoy unleashed a new wave of persecution against the Protestant Waldensians, the newspapers in England reported on this devilish crew of priests and Jesuits leading unspeakable atrocities against our Protestant brethren. Oliver Cromwell immediately sent an agent to the scene to verify the persecutions, and then he led a subscription list to raise funds to send relief to the Waldensians. And then he brought pressure to bear against the Duke of Savoy to stop this campaign, and he threatened to mobilize the English Navy and the English Army against the Duke of Savoy, and it stopped the war and stopped the persecution and saved the Waldensians. Oliver Cromwell was concerned about cruelty to animals, and he banned cockfights and bear baits. Vagrants who were often involved in drunkenness and theft were swept up by the military, evaluated by officers, and either imprisoned or sent to forced labor outside the country so there'd be no vagrants wandering around on the streets, littering and being a health hazard. He survived endless conspiracies and threats. Wars against Spain. His head of security uncovered numerous plots to murder the protector. At one point, the parliament offered him the crown. He refused the crown, saying, "I cannot undertake this government with the title of king." The whole of Europe was astonished that he would refuse the honours of the world, but Oliver Cromwell couldn't care tuppence for the honours of the world. He feared God. And England became a refuge for the persecuted. And people came from all over the world to find religious freedom and academic freedom in England that they could not find elsewhere. His navy defeated Spain, the superpower of the world, and showed the ascendancy of the English navy. English soldiers defeated the Spanish in Mardyk and Gravelines and Dunkirk, and has secured the freedom of Protestant Holland from what had previously been Spanish Netherlands. He also restored the House of Lords, because he said, you cannot have freedom without balance, and it was wrong to only have one House of Parliament. You need an upper house as well, a House of Chiefs, or what the British call a House of Lords. And he also gave freedom for the churches to determine good doctrine. Many times Oliver Cromwell's been blamed for the excesses of the Parliament of the Commonwealth, but these excesses, like banning of Christmas, closing down of theatres, was done by the Presbyterian Parliament while he was in the field fighting, and he rescinded it when he became Protector of England. He then developed a Protestant alliance, an alliance with Protestant countries around Europe. He established the Protestant League between Denmark and Sweden and Germany, and restored peace between Denmark and Sweden. And with the supremacy of the seas, he was able to challenge the Catholic powers and also the Muslim pirates of the Mediterranean. During the times of Oliver Cromwell, England was feared and respected throughout Europe and the world. He formed strong alliances with Protestant countries. He negotiated peace treaties with Protestant countries. He cleared the English Channel in the Mediterranean of all Muslim pirates. He expanded foreign trade and worked enthusiastically for the evangelization of the Indians in North America. During the time of Oliver Cromwell's protectorate, the whole world learned to respect England as a great sea power. In Geneva, in the Reformation Wall, next to Calvin and Knox, here is the statue of Oliver Cromwell. a political leader in the Reformation War, because he is not just a political leader. He was a Puritan. He was a reformer. He was a patron of the arts and of learning, a tireless worker to lay legal foundations and checks and balances for parliamentary rule. While some people have just attempted to describe Oliver Cromwell as a dictator, there was never any attempt to build a party around his personality. There was always respect for private property. There was always an effective and vocal opposition that was tolerated. Very few people were ever put to death under the Protectorate. Nobody for political reasons. It was for military or criminal reasons, and then only after a fair trial. He had a heritage of freedom. Liberty of conscience, freedom of the press flourished under Oliver Cromwell. Religious toleration reached new heights, unprecedented at that time. It is remarkable that in a bitter time of conflict, Oliver Cromwell could write, "We look for no compulsion but that of light and reason." He pioneered a professional army that people would not need to be afraid of, that would never enter people's houses and take property without consent and without compensation. He created the world's first global sea power. He laid the basis for the Industrial Revolution in the British Empire, and he preserved the common law. And he, by the way, started the practice of the English soldiers wearing red tunics as their uniform. His New Model Army is the first British soldiers to wear red coats. So the red coats dates back to the New Model Army. Luther and Knox and Cromwell and Calvin lifted millions from the swamps in which they'd been placed by elegant men in power. The foundational work of Oliver Cromwell helped establish checks and balances for the rule of law. And it triumphed in the United States of America as people were inspired by the example of Oliver Cromwell and the Parliament of England. And they instituted many of the same principles of government, including the lower and upper house, and checks and balances in America, which Cromwell worked so hard to achieve in England. Otto Scott, American historian, writes, "Our War of Independence raised men like Cromwell's, who fought like Cromwell's, for the same reason that Cromwell fought. The men at Philadelphia, who declared America's independence, echoed the history of the 1640s and 1650s of England, when they wrote the Constitution with its limitations on the powers of Congress and on the presidency and on the court. These were lessons that Cromwell learned in the hard struggle of trying to establish a free and just system in England. And when the Americans said in the Constitution that this nation would not have an established church, they were reflecting the experience of their forefathers with Archbishop Laud and his successors in England. The American War of Independence raised these men." And so you can see that Oliver Cromwell's Christian revolution in England succeeded in the American War of Independence. And in a very real sense, you can say that the unique form of government established in America could not have been possible without the English Civil War, Oliver Cromwell, and the English Parliament, especially without the Puritans and the Puritan faith. When they spoke about open doors to all, open careers to all, they spoke in accents of Cromwell and the Calvinists, the Independents and of the Congregationalists, and the Puritans and the Presbyterians, and the Levellers, and those who fought under their banners. All this and more came from the great Christian Revolution. All the liberties that people know come from Christianity, from its lessons about individuals and the state, about God and his covenant, about fulfilling God's word to bring justice, truth, faith, and joy to the world. And you see, the solution to our problems is not one man, one vote. The solution to our problems is not Parliament. The solution to our problems is not a good constitution. The solution to our problems is a God-fearing people, God-fearing Parliament, God-fearing upper house and lower house, God-fearing checks and balances, God-fearing judiciary and electorate, well-informed. And all these things, you need to have so many things. It's not just one thing that'll bring freedom. You need lots of things to bring freedom in a country, including excellent schools and a form of rule and law and a good army, a professional army. Oliver Cromwell had a tremendous vision for world missions. He established a society for the propagation of the gospel in New England to reach the Indians. He raised an enormous sum of money towards his first evangelical missionary society. Oliver Cromwell was keenly interested in the evangelization of the Red Indians in America, and he proposed a comprehensive plan for world evangelism. He divided up the world into four great mission fields to be systematically evangelized. Unfortunately, the death of Oliver Cromwell and the restoration of the monarchy in England under Charles II set back the cause of world missions by a good century. He's one of the greatest English leaders of all time. President Theodore Roosevelt of America said, Oliver Cromwell's the greatest Englishman of the 17th century, the greatest soldier statesman of the 17th century. His sacrifices and achievements produced the English-speaking world as we know it today, which includes those of us who speak English. And Theodore Roosevelt made comparisons with the Confederate General Stonewall Jackson and Robert E. Lee with Oliver Cromwell in the American War of Independence and with the English Civil War. One of the greatest of all Englishmen, by far the greatest king or ruler of England itself, a man who in times that tried men's souls dealt with the vast problems and solved tremendous problems, a man who erred but it strove mightily towards the light as it was given to him to see the light. A man who had the welfare of his countrymen and the greatness of his country very close to his heart, who sought to make the great laws of righteousness living forces in the government of this world. And so one of the great results that came out of the English Civil War was the Westminster Confession of Faith of 1646, one of the finest statements on Christian belief in history. The Westminster Confession of Faith and the Westminster Standards, the Westminster Catechism, the Shorter Catechism, the Larger Catechism, are absolutely outstanding examples, and all this came under the time of the English Civil War and the parliamentary protection. So, does anyone have any questions at all? Any comments on this, the greatest century of the Puritans? While you're thinking of your questions, let me actually just give a few more points on the greatest century of the Puritans to wrap it up. 1648 was the Peace of Westphalia, which ended the 30 Years' War and established the principle that each of the states would allow religious toleration or freedom to some extent. Also, 1652, the Protestant Dutch landed at Cape Town and established a Protestant outpost at the Cape of Good Hope. 1666, the Great Fire destroyed most of London, which was tragic, but on the other hand, it destroyed also the plague-ridden, rat-infested houses, enabled him to build a better and newer city that was more hygienic. In 1678, John Bunyan published Pilgrim's Progress, one of the greatest books in history, one of the best sellers of all time. Outside the Bible, Pilgrim's Progress is the best-selling English book of all time. And if you haven't read Pilgrim's Progress, well worth it. That is an example of a Puritan vision of the gospel and of discipleship. A tremendous resource for the church. The Prince of Preachers, Charles Spurgeon, said he read Pilgrim's Progress 100 times in his life. So, the great names of the greatest century of the Puritans, the 17th century, Gustavus Adolphus, the Lion from the North, the King of Sweden who saved Protestantism. Oliver Cromwell, the chief of men, the Puritan politician and general who won the English Civil War and established Lex Rex. John Owen, who was the secretary, who was the chaplain of Oliver Cromwell, who wrote some of the finest English works ever written. John Bunyan, the Puritan soldier of Oliver Cromwell, one of the Ironsides who wrote Pilgrim's Progress and the Holy War. And this is a picture of the world at that time, at the end of the century of the Puritans. You can see the Russian Empire now stretched across the whole of Asia. You can see the Mongol empire in India stretching across most of India now. You can see the Viceroy of Spain has taken over most of South and Central America. You can see the Ottoman Empire stretch across the whole of North Africa and parts of the Middle East. A century of war. 1685, Louis XIV revoked the Edict of Nantes and exiled hundreds of thousands of French Protestants who had to flee France for their life. And over 250,000 French Huguenots fled, some as far as America, South Africa, Germany. 1685, the births of two of the greatest musicians in history, Johann Sebastian Bach and George Frederick Handel. Handel produced Handel's Messiah, one of the greatest of all. 1683, the siege of Vienna, the last great threat to the heart of Europe, as the Turks attempted to seize this great capital in the heart of Europe, and on the 11th of September, September the 11th, 1683, the siege was lifted, and the Muslims were cast back. So that marks the end of the greatest century of the Puritans. Any questions at all on the 17th century? Yes.
Yes, sir, I want to know, how does the destruction of the World Trade Center fit in the history of the church?
It does fit in the church because it marks a major turning point in every way in history. First of all, more books have been written on Islam since September the 11th, 2001, than in all of history before. More prayer has been focused on the Muslim world since September the 11th, 2001, than ever before. More missionaries have been mobilized into the Muslim world since 2001 than were mobilized before. Not only that, but we have seen wars develop, which is going to affect the future of the church, I think in many cases adversely, because we have seen the number of Christians in the Middle East decrease dramatically. We have lost over 2 million Christians from the Middle East, have fled the Middle East since the 2001 events, because the Muslim countries are getting more extreme and they are persecuting the Christians even worse since 2001. We've seen a more radicalization of Islam. But it's also waking up people to the threats of Islam more than ever before. But, as I'm pointing out from church history, the Muslims don't choose the dates accidentally. September the 11th has always been known in church history as the date of two of the greatest victories of Islam. The lifting of the siege of Malta on September the 11th, 1565, and the lifting of the siege of Vienna on the 11th of November, on September the 11th in 1683. And so I believe the Muslims chose their terror attack on the World Trade Center in 2001 on the same date to try and replace those dates as dates of defeat of Islam to be a victory of Islam on the same date. Any other questions or comments?
Thank you, sir. My question is, if you can explain the difference between Presbyterian and the Episcopal Church, and who was the founder of those churches?
Thank you. The Episcopalians, that's another word for Anglican or Church of England. The Anglicans are Protestants, but they are hierarchical. They have an archbishop at the top who, under him are bishops, and under bishops are the clergy. The Presbyterians are ruled by presbyters or elders. Now, John Knox is the founder of Presbyterianism. Whereas the founder of the Anglicans, you could say, is Thomas Cranmer, at least the founder of the Protestant Anglicans. The Anglicans can point to some passages in the Bible, such as where the Apostle Paul told Titus to appoint rulers and bishops and leaders in the areas he is responsible for, and even to Timothy, telling him to appoint. So you can see what looks like an episcopal form where Paul, the Apostle, says to his mentor, the one he's mentoring, Timothy or Titus or Silas, to appoint bishops. And so you do see some examples in the Bible of what seems to be an episcopal form of government. But you also see in the Bible examples of Presbyterian government, where the elders gathered together and the elders decided, such as in the church in Antioch. So you seem to see a rule by elders. But you can also point to other parts of the Bible, in the book of Acts in particular, where you see the whole church gathered together, or the congregation made decision. Congregational forms of church government, which the Baptists and the Independents and the Congregationals use. So I look at the Bible and I can see Episcopal form of government, I can see Presbyterian form of government, and I can see congregational or independent form of government. And you can see all three examples of. So it seems that we should be tolerant when it comes to forms of church government. Let different local congregations decide. Now, I personally hold to congregational form of church government. I'm a Baptist. I believe in decentralization. Let each congregation be duly constituted. Now, let's work together with other congregations. But the Presbyterians would say the elders decide. The Episcopalians would say the bishop and the archbishop decides. So the Anglicans or the Episcopalians are hierarchical, whereas the Presbyterians are just the elders are making the decisions, whereas the independents or the congregational church are deciding that the whole congregation makes the decisions. And the congregation can vote out the elders or deacons and the pastor, and the congregation is the government. It's congregational self-government. Whereas the Presbyterians, the elders decide, and the Episcopalians, the bishops decide. So that's the difference between those forms of government. Cromwell was saying we should allow any form of church government if they're Protestant, and the church should be free to have in their different local manifestations whatever form they wish. He didn't want to force from the top one down. Before the time of Oliver Cromwell, you had to be, if you were in a Presbyterian area like Scotland, you had to be Presbyterian. If you were in an Anglican area or Episcopalian such as England, you had to be Episcopalian. And there was no toleration of different denominational views within a country. But what Oliver Cromwell's great achievement was religious toleration, religious freedom, liberty of conscience. And that's a good thing. Any other questions or comments? Yes.
Gaston Vastadopoulos, the line from the north, it parades a German from the Catholic League and the Australian Empire. I see in your PowerPoint presentation, it indicates 1631, and yet in the manual I'm seeing 1632, but I can't. In the manual I'm seeing 1632, but in the PowerPoint it is 1631.
That is true. He actually came into Germany in 1631, but the decisive victory wasn't 1632. So that is the only difference, is the fact that it's true that he entered Germany 1631, but he won the battle. The main battles were won in 1632. So that could explain the discrepancy. Any other questions or comments?
European history indicated that Italy and United Kingdom are the best countries in terms of high number of churches and the best buildings of churches. So,
sorry, you said that because I certainly didn't.
Some of the history books.
Yeah, Italy, of course, is Catholic and England is Protestant, so I would not have put them in the same category.
So if you see today, many of the churches are converted from the churches to the museums and different business purposes. So I want to know from you, according to you as an international doctor, what is the cause actually?
The cause? Right.
I hope we will get a chance to get to that, to deal with the causes and the consequences and the catastrophe of World War I. You've got a whole chapter on that, on how Europe wiped themselves out. Now, I don't know that we will have time to get to it, but it's in your manual, the causes, consequences, and catastrophe of World War I, as Europe turned on themselves, were tricked and manipulated by evil bankers and by Freemasons who had an anti-Christian agenda to derail the greatest century of missions into the worst century of persecution. The 19th century is the greatest century of missions. We'll see that just later on in our presentations. But the 20th century has been the worst century of persecution. More Christians have been martyred for Christ in the 20th century than all previous centuries combined. The 20th century has been the worst century for the church in history in terms of the number of Christians persecuted. and also how far we've fallen back and lost territory. So that I've given another chapter also on how the New World Order is hijacking civilization, and also on the greatest killer and on guilt manipulation. So there's a few things where I've tried to deal with the issues of how Europe in particular has been derailed from being such a great Christian continent into now a terrible mission field that's very dark and with very little real spiritual life there. Great buildings, but in many cases no worship taking place in these wonderful cathedrals. So that is a catastrophe which we need to study. I don't think we are going to have the time before the exams tomorrow to cover that. That, though, is in your manual. I'm convinced that Europe is in serious backsliding and apostasy, and it's a mission field. We need to win it back. So we need to learn those lessons. But of course, right now, we are dealing with the lessons of the 17th century, and then before lunch, we'll still try to cover the 18th and 19th centuries. The 20th century, we'll have to wait for another time, because I don't see that we have enough time in our schedule to get there, but we've got it in the manual. Okay, and of course, we write about it frequently. If you're not on the Frontline Fellowship mailing list, get on it, and you can go on our website. We're dealing with this very issue a lot, because this year, 2014, is the 100th anniversary of the outbreak of World War I, the greatest catastrophe in history, the worst setback in civilization ever. And we need to learn the lessons of the First World War and how disastrous it is when Christians fight one another. What's going on in Sudan is tragic today, but it is small compared to the tragedy that Europe brought on themselves in 1914, when Christian nations destroyed one another, killing millions of one another in the most colossal conflict ever. Now, to let you know, I've been to one battlefield in Belgium, Ypres. In 10 kilometers around Ypres are 156 war cemeteries for the British alone. I saw 65 Hammonds, relatives of mine's names, on the walls at that one battlefield. I only went to 6 of the cemeteries. And the people whose names are on the walls are ones they couldn't find the bodies for, because they were so destroyed by artillery. So their names are on the walls. Those who they had a body for, they buried, and they've got a cross with them on. I'm not counting the crosses. How many Hammonds are buried? I don't know. I'm just talking about the walls. I saw the names of 65 of my ancestors on the walls of one battlefield in Europe from the First World War. The destruction of Christian nations in the First World War was absolutely unbelievable. And we need to understand these lessons, because one of the greatest disasters is when the church gets distracted from what we're here on earth for, and we end up fighting one another. It's true on national level, political level, tribal level, denominational level. We cannot waste our time and energy on fighting one another. We must keep our focus on fighting the enemy.